He found himself confronting an all-white room with steel fixtures and steel chairs and steel desk, all bolted down, a hospital-like room, purified and sterile and cold, with the light too bright. In fact, to the right stood a weighing scale with a sign, "Have technician only adjust." Two deputies regarded him, both in full uniform of the Orange County Sheriff's Office, but with medical stripes.
You are Officer Fred?"
one of them, with a handlebar mustache, said.
"Yes, sir," Fred said. He felt scared.
"All right, Fred. First let me state that, as you undoubtedly are aware, your briefings and debriefings are monitored and later played back for study, in case anything was missed at the original sessions. Now, this is SOP, of course, and applies to all officers reporting in orally, not you alone."
The other medical deputy said,
"Plus all other contacts you maintain with the department, such as phone contacts and additional activities, such as your recent public speech in Anaheim to the Rotary Club boys."
"Lions," Fred said.
"Do you take Substance D?"
the left-hand medical deputy said.
"That question," the other said, "is moot, because it's taken for granted that in your work you're compelled to. So, don't answer. Not that it's incriminating, but it's simply moot."
He indicated a table on which a bunch of blocks and other riffraff, colorful plastic objects lay, plus peculiar items that Officer Fred could not identify.
Step over here and be seated, Officer Fred. We are going to administer, briefly, several easy tests. This won't consume much of your time, and there will be no physical discomfort involved."
About that speech I gave, Fred said.
"What this is about," the left-hand medical deputy said as he seated himself and produced a pen and some forms, "stems from a recent departmental survey showing that several undercover agents working in this area have been admitted to neural aphasia clinics during the past month."
"You're conscious of the high factor of addictiveness of Substance D," the other deputy said to Fred.
"Sure," Fred said. "Of course I am."
"We're going to give you these tests now," the seated deputy said, "in this order, starting with what we call the BG, or..."
"You think I'm an addict?" Fred said.
"Well, whether you're an addict or not, that isn't a prime issue, since a blocking agent is expected from the Army Chemical Warfare Division sometime within the next 5 years. These tests do not pertain to the addictive properties of Substance D, but to... well, let me give you this set ground test first, which determines your ability readily to distinguish set from ground. See this geometric diagram?"
He laid a drawn-on card before Fred on the table.
"Within the apparently meaningless lines is a familiar object that we would all recognize. You are to tell me what the..."
Item. In July 1969, Joseph E. Bogan published his revolutionary article, "The Other Side of the Brain, an Appositional Mind." In this article, he quoted an obscure Dr. A. L. Wiggin, who in 1844 wrote, "The mind is essentially dual, like the organs by which it is exercised. This idea has presented itself to me, and I have dwelt on it for more than a quarter of a century, without being able to find a single valid or even plausible objection. I believe myself then able to prove, 1. That each cerebrum is a distinct and perfect whole as an organ of thought. 2. That a separate and distinct process of thinking or ratiocination may be carried on in each cerebrum simultaneously." In his article, Bogan concluded, "I believe, with Wiggin, that each of us has two minds in one person. There is a host of detail to be marshaled in this case. But we must eventually confront directly the principal resistance to the Wiggin view. That is, the subjective feeling possessed by each of us that we are one. This inner conviction of oneness is a most cherished opinion of Western man. Object is, and point to it in the total field."
"I'm being mutton-jeffed," Fred thought.
"What is all this?" he said, gazing at the deputy and not the diagram. "I'll bet it's the Lions Club speech," he said. He was positive. The seated deputy said,
"In many of those taking Substance D, a split between the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere of the brain occurs. There's a loss of proper gestalting, which is a defect within both the percept and the cognitive systems, although apparently the cognitive system continues to function normally. But what is now received from the percept system is contaminated by being split, so it too, therefore, fails gradually to function, progressively deteriorating. Have you located the familiar object in this line drawing? Can you find it for me?
Fred said, "You're not talking about heavy metals trace deposits in the neuroreceptor sites, are you? Irreversible?"
"No," the standing deputy said. "This is not brain damage, but a form of toxicity, brain toxicity. It's a toxic brain psychosis affecting the percept system by splitting it. What you have before you, this BG test, measures the accuracy of your percept system to act as a unified whole. Can you see the form here? It should jump right out at you."
"As a Coke bottle," Fred said.
"A soda pop bottle is correct,"
the seated deputy said, and whipped the drawing away, replacing it with another. "Have you noticed anything," Fred said, "in studying my briefings and like that? Anything slushed?" "It's the speech," he thought. "Yeah, what about the speech I gave?" he said. "Did I show bilateral dysfunction there? Is that why I've been hauled in here? For these tests?" He had read about these split-brain tests, given by the department from time to time.
"No, this is routine," the seated deputy said. "We realize, Officer Fred, that undercover agents must of necessity take drugs in the line of duty. Those who've had to go into federal..."
"Permanently?" Fred asked.
"Well, not many permanently. Again, this is percept contamination that could, in the course of time, rectify itself as..."
"Murky," Fred said. "It murks over everything."
"Are you getting any cross-chatter?"
one of the deputies asked him suddenly. "What?" he said uncertainly.
"Between hemispheres. If there's damage to the left hemisphere, where the linguistic skills are normally located, then sometimes the right hemisphere will fill in to the best of its ability."
I don't know," he said. "Not that I'm aware of."
"Thoughts not your own. As if another person or mind were thinking. But different from the way you would think. Even foreign words that you don't know. But that it's learned from peripheral perception sometime during your lifetime."
"No, nothing like that. I'd notice that."
"You probably would. From people with left hemisphere damage who've reported it, evidently it's a pretty shattering experience."
"Well, I guess I'd notice that."
"It used to be believed that the right hemisphere had no linguistic faculties at all, but that was before so many people had screwed up their left hemispheres with drugs and gave it, the right, a chance to come on, to fill the vacuum."
"I'll certainly keep my eyes open for that," Fred said, and heard the mere mechanical quality of his voice, like that of a dutiful child in school, agreeing to obey whatever dull order was imposed on him by those in authority. Those taller than he was, and in a position to impose their strength and will on him, whether it was reasonable or not. "Just agree," he thought, "and do what you're told."
What do you see in the second picture?"
"A sheep," Fred said.
"Show me the sheep."
The seated deputy leaned forward and rotated the picture.
"An impairment and set background discrimination gets you into a heap of trouble. Instead of perceiving no forms, you perceive faulty forms."
"Like dog shit," Fred thought. "Dog shit certainly would be considered a faulty form, by any standard.
The data indicate that the mute, minor hemisphere is specialized for gestalt perception, being primarily a synthesist in dealing with information input. The speaking, major hemisphere, in contrast, seems to operate in a more logical, analytic, computer-like fashion, and the findings suggest that a possible reason for cerebral lateralization in man is basic incompatibility of language functions on the one hand and synthetic perceptual functions on the other."
Felt ill and depressed, almost as much as he had during his Lions Club speech. "There's no sheep there, is there?" he said. "But was I close?"
"This is not a Rorschach test," the seated deputy said, "where a muddled blot can be interpreted many ways by many subjects. In this, one specific object as such has been delineated, and one only. In this case, it's a dog."
"A what?" Fred said.
"A dog."
"How can you tell it's a dog? He saw no dog. Show me."
The deputy... "This conclusion finds its experimental proof in the split-brain animal,
whose two hemispheres can be trained to perceive, consider, and act independently. In the human, where propositional thought is typically lateralized in one hemisphere, the other hemisphere evidently specializes in a different mode of thought, which may be called appositional. The rules or methods by which propositional thought is elaborated on this side of the brain, the side which speaks, reads, and writes, have been subjected to analyses of syntax, semantics, mathematical logic, etc., for many years. The rules by which appositional thought is elaborated on the other side of the brain will need study for many years to come. Turn the card over. On the back, the formal, stark, simple outline of a dog had been inscribed, and now Fred recognized it as the shape drawn within the lines on the front side. In fact, it was a specific type of dog, a greyhound with a drawn-in gut. "What's that mean?" he said, "that I saw a sheep instead."
"Probably just a psychological block," the standing deputy said, shifting his weight about. "Only when the whole set of cards is run, and then we have the several other tests."
"Why this is a superior test to the Rorschach?" the seated deputy interrupted, producing the next drawing. "Is that it is not interpretive. There are as many wrongs as you can think up, but only one right. The right object that the U.S. Department of Psych Graphics drew into it and certified for it for each card. That's what's right, because it is handed down from Washington. And you either get it or you don't. And if you show a run of not getting it, then we have a fix on a functional impairment in perception and we try you out for a while, until you test okay later on."
"A federal clinic?" Fred said.
"Yes. Now, what do you see in this drawing, among these particular black and white lines?"
"Death City," Fred thought as he studied the drawing. "That is what I see. Death in pluriform, not in just the one correct form, but throughout. Little three-foot-high contract men on carts."
"Just tell me," Fred said, "was it the Lions Club speech that alerted you?"
The two medical deputies exchanged glances.
"No," the standing one said finally.
"Well, it had to do with an exchange that was actually off the cuff. In fact, just bullshitting between you and Hank. About 2 weeks ago. You realize there's a technological lag in processing all this garbage, all this raw information that flows in. They haven't gotten to your speech yet, and they won't, in fact, for another couple of days."
"Oh, what was this bullshitting?"
"Something about a stolen bicycle," the other deputy said. "A so-called seven-speed bicycle. I mean, you'd been trying to figure out where the missing three speeds had gone. Was that it?"
Again, they glanced at each other, the two medical deputies.
"You felt they had been left on the floor of the garage it was stolen from?"
"Oh, hell," Fred protested. "That was Charles Freck's fault, not mine. He's got everybody's ass in an uproar talking about it. I just thought it was funny."
Barris, standing in the middle of the living room, with a great big new shiny bike, very pleased.
"Look what I got for $20.
Freck.
What is it?
Barris.
A bike. A 10-speed racing bike, virtually brand new. I saw it in the neighbor's yard and asked about it, and they had four of them, so I made an offer of $20 cash, and they sold it to me.
Colored people.
They even hoisted it over the fence for me."
Luckman.
"I didn't know you could get a 10-speed nearly new for $20. That's amazing what you can get for $20.
Donna.
"It resembles the one the chick across the street from me had that got ripped off about a month ago. Have they probably ripped it off, those black guys?"
Arctor.
"Hey, sure they did, if they got four and selling it that cheap."
Donna.
"You ought to give it back to the chick across the street from me if it's hers. But anyhow, you should let her look at it to see if it's hers."
Barris.
"It's a man's bike, so it can't be."
Frack.
"Why is it 10 speeds when it's only got 7 gears?
Barris. Astonished.
"What?"
Frack, going over to bike and pointing.
Look, 5 gears here. 2 gears here at the other end of the chain. 5 and 2.
When the optic chiasm of a cat, or a monkey, is divided sagittally,
The input into the right eye goes only into the right hemisphere, and similarly, the left eye informs only the left hemisphere. If an animal with this operation is trained to choose between two symbols while using only one eye, later tests show that it can make the proper choice with the other eye. But if the commissures, especially the corpus callosum, have been severed before training, the initially covered eye in its ipsilateral hemisphere must be trained from the beginning. That is, the training does not transfer from one hemisphere to the other if the commissures have been cut. This is the fundamental split-brain experiment of Myers and Sperry, 1953, Sperry, 1961, Myers, 1965, Sperry, 1967.
Makes seven. So it's only a seven-speed bike.
Luckman.
Well, yeah, but even a seven-speed racing bike's worth $20. He's still got a good buy.
Barris. Nettled. Those colored people told me it was 10 speeds. It's a rip-off. Everyone gathers to examine bike. They count the gears again and again. Freck.
Oh, now I count 8. 6 in front, 2 in back. That makes 8.
Arctor, logically. But it should be 10. There are no 7 or 8 speed bikes. Not that I ever heard of. What do you suppose happened to the missing gears? Barris. Those colored guys must have been working on it, taking it apart with improper tools and no technical knowledge, and when they reassembled it, they left 3 gears lying on the floor of their garage. They're probably still lying there. Luckman.
Well, then we should go ask for the missing gears back.
Barris, pondering angrily. But that's where the ripoff is. They'll probably offer to sell them to me, not give them to me as they should. I wonder what else they've damaged. Inspects entire bike. Luckman.
If we all go together, they'll give them to us. You can bet on it, man. We'll all go, right?
Looks around for agreement. Donna. Are you positive there's only 7 gears? Freck.
8.
Donna. 7, 8. Anyhow, I mean, before you go over there, ask somebody. I mean, it doesn't look to me like they've done anything to it, like taking it apart. Before you go over there and lay heavy shit on them, find out. Can you dig it?
Arctor.
She's right.
Luckman.
Who should we ask? Who do we know that's an authority on racing bikes?
Freck.
Well, let's ask the first person we see. Yeah, let's wheel it out the door, and when some freak comes along, we'll ask him. That way we'll get a disheartened viewpoint.
They collectively wheel bike out front, right off encounter young black man parking his car. They point to the 7, 8 gears questioningly and ask how many there are, although they can see, except for Charles Freck, that there are only 7. 5 at one end of the chain, 2 at the other. 5 and 2 add up to 7. They can ascertain it with their own eyes. What's going on? Young black man, calmly.
What you have to do is multiply the number of gears in front by the number in the rear. It's not an adding, but a multiplying. Because you see, the chain leaps across from gear to gear, and in terms of gear ratios, you obtain 5.
He indicates the 5 gears.
Times 1 of the 2 in front.
He points to that.
Which gives you 1 times 5, which is 5. And then, when you shift with this lever on the handlebar,
he demonstrates,
the chain jumps to the other 1 of the 2 in front and interacts with the same 5 in the back all over again, which is an additional 5. The addition involved is 5 plus 5, which is 10. Do you see how that works? You see, gear ratios are always derived by...
They thank him and silently wheel the bike back inside the house. The young black man, whom they have never seen before, and who is no more than 17 and driving an incredibly beat-up old transportation-type car, goes on locking up, and they close the front door of the house and just stand there. Luckman.
Well, anybody got any dope? Where there's dope, there's hope.
No one. All the evidence indicates that separation of the hemispheres creates 2 independent spheres of consciousness within a single cranium, that is to say, within a single organism.
This conclusion is disturbing to some people who view consciousness as an indivisible property of the human brain. It seems premature to others who insist that the capacities revealed thus far for the right hemisphere are at the level of an automaton. There is, to be sure, hemispheric inequality in the present cases, but it may well be a characteristic on the individuals we have studied. It is entirely possible that if a human brain were divided in a very young person, both hemispheres could as a result separately and independently develop mental functions of a high order at the level attained only in the left hemisphere of normal individuals. Laughs.
We know that you were one of the people in that group, the seated medical deputy said. It doesn't matter which one.
None of you could look at the bike and perceive the simple mathematical operation involved in determining the number of its very small system of gear ratios. In the deputy's voice, Fred heard a certain compassion, a measure of being kind.
An operation like that constitutes a junior high school aptitude test. Were y'all stoned?
No, Fred said.
They give aptitude tests like that to children, the other medical deputy said.
So, what was wrong, Fred? The first deputy asked.
I forget, Fred said.
He shut up now.
And then he said, It sounds to me like a cognitive fuck-up rather than perceptive. Isn't abstract thinking involved in a thing like that?
Not. You might imagine so, the seated deputy said. But tests show that the cognitive system fails because it isn't receiving accurate data. In other words, the inputs are distorting in such a fashion that when you go to reason about what you see, you reason wrongly because you don't...
The deputy gestured, trying to find a way to express it.
But a 10-speed bike has 7 gears, Fred said. Oh, what we saw was accurate. 2 in front, 5 in back.
But you didn't perceive, any of you, how they interact. 5 in back with each of the 2 in front, as the black told you. Was he a highly educated man?
Probably not, Fred said.
What the black saw, the standing deputy said,
was different from what all of you saw. He saw 2 separate connecting lines between the rear gear system and the front. 2 simultaneous different lines perceptible to him between the gears in front running to each of the 5 back ones in turn. What you saw was 1 connective to all back ones.
But that would make 6 gears, then, Fred said.
2 front gears, but 1 connective. Which is an inaccurate perception. And nobody taught that black boy that. What they taught him to do, if anyone taught him at all, was to figure out, cognitively, what the meaning of those 2 connectives were. You missed one of them entirely, all of you. What you did was that although you counted 2 front gears, you perceived them as a homogeneity.
I'll do better next time, Fred said.
Next time what? When you buy a ripped-off 10-speed bike? Or abstracting all daily percept input?
Fred remained silent.
Let's continue the test, the seated deputy said. What do you see in this one, Fred?
Plastic dog shit, Fred said. Like they sell here in the Los Angeles area. Can I go now? It was the Lions Club speech all over again. Both deputies, however, laughed.
You know, Fred, the seated one said, if you can keep your sense of humor like you do, you'll perhaps make it.
Make it? Fred echoed. Make what? The team? The chick? Make good, make do, make outs, make sense, make money, make time?
Define your terms. The Latin for make is fuckery. Which always reminds me of fuckery, which is Latin for to fuck, and I haven't...
The brain of the higher animals, including man, is a double organ consisting of right and left hemispheres connected by an isthmus of nerve tissue called the corpus callosum. Some 15 years ago, Ronald E. Myers and R.W. Sperry, then at the University of Chicago, made a surprising discovery. When this connection between the 2 halves of the cerebrum was cut, each hemisphere functioned independently, as if it were a complete brain.
been getting it on worth jack shit lately. Plastic shit or otherwise, any kind of shit. If you boys are psychologist types and you've been listening to my endless debriefings with Hank, what the hell is Donna's handle? How do I get next to her? I mean, how is it done? With that kind of sweet, unique, stubborn little chick?
Each girl is different, the seated deputy said.
I mean, approach her ethically, Fred said. Not cram her with reds and booze and then stick it into her while she's lying on the living room floor.
Buy her flowers,
the standing deputy said.
What? Fred said, his suit-filtered eyes opening wide.
Oh, this time of year you can get little spring flowers at the nursery departments of, say, Penny's or Kmart. You know, or an azalea.
Flowers, Fred murmured. You mean plastic flowers or real flowers? Real ones, I guess.
The plastic ones are no good, the seated deputy said. They look like they're, well, fake. Somehow fake.
Can I leave now? Fred asked.
After an exchange of glances, both deputies nodded.
We'll evaluate you some other time, Fred, the standing one said. It's not that urgent. Hank will notify you of a later appointment time.
For some obscure reason, Fred felt like shaking hands with them before he left, but he did not. He just left, saying nothing, a little down and a little bewildered because, probably, of the way it had shot out of left field at him. So suddenly,
they've been going over and over my material, he thought, trying to find signs of my being burned out, and they did find some. Enough, anyhow, to want to run these tests. Spring flowers, he thought, as he reached the elevator. Little ones. Oh, they probably grow close to the ground, and a lot of people step on them. Do they grow wild? Or in special commercial vats, or in huge enclosed farms? I wonder what the country is like. The fields and like that, the strange smells. And he wondered, where do you find that? Where do you go, and how do you get there and stay there? What kind of trip is that, and what kind of ticket does it take? And who do you buy the ticket from? Andy thought, I would like to take someone with me when I go there. Maybe Donna. But how do you ask that? Ask a chick that. When you don't even know how to get next to her. When you've been scheming on her and achieving nothing. Not even step one. We should hurry, he thought. Because later on all the spring flowers like they told me about will be dead.
Chapter 8.
On his way over to Bob Arctor's house, where a bunch of heads could usually be found for a mellow turned-on time, Charles Freck worked out a gag to put old Barris on, to pay him back for the spleen jive at the Fiddler's Three restaurant that day. In his head, as he skillfully avoided the radar traps that the police kept everywhere, the police radar vans checking out drivers usually took the disguise of old raunchy VW vans, painted dull brown, driven by bearded freaks. When he saw such vans, he slowed. He ran a preview fantasy number of his put-on. Freck, casually.
I bought a methadrine plant today.
Barris, with a snotty expression on his face.
Methadrine is a Benny, like speed. It's crank, it's crystal, it's amphetamine, it's made synthetically in a lab. So it isn't organic, like pot. There's no such thing as a methadrine plant like there is a pot plant.
Freck, springing the punchline on him.
I inherited $40,000 from an uncle and purchased a plant hidden in this dude's garage where he makes methadrine. Ha ha ha! I mean, he's got a factory there where he manufactures meth. Plant in the sense of...
He couldn't get it phrased exactly right as he drove, because part of his mind stayed on the vehicles around him and the lights. But he knew when he got to Bob's house, he'd lay it on Barris
super good.
And especially if a bunch of people were there, Barris would rise to the bait and be visible to everyone flat out as a clear and evident asshole. And that would super pay him back, because Barris, worse than anybody else, couldn't stand to be made fun of. When he pulled up, he found Barris outdoors, working on Bob Arctor's car. The hood was up, and both Barris and Arctor stood together with a pile of car tools.
Hey, man,
Freck said, slamming his door and sauntering casually over.
Barris,
he said right off in a cool way, putting his hand on Barris's shoulder to attract his attention.
Later,
Barris growled. He had his repair clothes on. Grease and like that covered the already dirty fabric. Freck said,
I bought a methadrine plant today.
With an impatient scowl, Barris said, how big?
What do you mean?
How big a plant?
Freck
said, wondering how to go on. How much did you pay for it? Arctor said, also greasy from the car repair. They had the carb off, Freck saw, air filter, hoses, and all. Freck said,
about $10.
Jim could have gotten it for you cheaper, Arctor said, resuming his labors. Couldn't you, Jim?
Oh, they're practically giving meth plants away, Barris said.
Well, it's the whole fucking garage, Freck protested. A factory. Now, it turns out a million tabs a day. The pill rolling machinery and everything. Everything.
All that cost $10, Barris said, grinning widely.
Where is it located? Arctor said.
Yeah, not around here,
Freck said uneasily.
Hey, fuck it, you guys.
Pausing in his work, Barris did a lot of pausing in his work, whether anyone was talking to him or not. Barris said,
you know, Freck, if you drop or shoot too much meth, you start talking like Donald Duck.
So?
Freck said.
Then nobody can understand you, Barris said.
Arctor said, what'd you say, Barris? I couldn't understand you. His face dancing with merriment, Barris made his voice sound like Donald Duck's. Freck and Arctor grinned and enjoyed it. Barris went on and on, gesturing finally at the carburetor. What about the carburetor? Arctor said, not smiling now. Barris, in his regular voice, but still grinning widely, said, oh, you've got a bent choke shaft. The whole carb should be rebuilt. Otherwise, the choke's going to shut on you while you're driving along the freeway, and then you'll find your motor is flooded and dead, and some asshole will rear-end you. And possibly, in addition, that raw gas washing down the cylinder walls, if it goes on long enough, will wash the lubrication away, so your cylinders will be scored and permanently damaged, and then you'll need them reboard. Why is the choke rod bent? Arctor asked. Shrugging, Barris resumed taking apart the carb. He did not answer. He left that up to Arctor and to Charles Freck, who knew nothing about engines, especially complex repairs like this. Coming out of the house, Luckman, wearing a snazzy shirt and tight high-style Levi jeans, carrying a book and wearing shades, said,
I phoned, and they're checking to see what a rebuilt carb will set you back for this car. They'll phone in a while, so I left the front door open.
Barris said, you could put a full barrel on instead of this two while you're at it, but you'd have to put on a new manifold. We could pick up a used one for not very much.
It would idle too high, Luckman said. We're like a Rochester four barrel.
Is that what you mean? It wouldn't shift properly. It wouldn't upshift. The idling jets could be replaced with smaller jets, Barris said. That would compensate. And with a tack, he could watch his RPM so it didn't over-rev. He'd know by the tack when it wasn't upshifting. Usually, just backing off on the gas pedal causes it to upshift if the automatic linkage to the transmission doesn't do it. I know where we can get a tack, too. In fact, I have one.
Yeah, Luckman said. Well, if you tromp down heavy on the step-down passing gear to get a lot of torque suddenly in an emergency on the freeway, it'd downshift and rev up so high it'd blow the head gasket, or worse. A lot worse. It'd blow up the whole engine.
Barris patiently said, he'd see the tack needle jump and he'd back right off.
While passing, Luckman said, halfway past a fucking big semi. Shit, he'd have to keep barreling on, high revs or not. He'd have to blow up the engine rather than back off, because if he backed off, he'd never get around what he was trying to pass.
Momentum, Barris said. In a car this heavy, momentum would carry him on by even if he backed off.
What about uphill? Luckman said. Momentum doesn't carry you very far uphill when you're passing.
To Arctor, Barris said, what does this car...
He bent to see what make it was.
This...
His lips moved. Olds.
Oh, it weighs about 1,000 pounds,
Arctor said. Charles Freck saw him wink toward Luckman.
You're right, then,
Paris agreed.
There wouldn't be much inertia mass at that lead weight.
Or would there? He groped for a pen and something to write on.
1,000 pounds traveling at 80 miles an hour builds up force equal to...
That's 1,000 pounds, Arctor put in, with the passengers in it and with a full tank of gas and a big carton of bricks in the trunk.
How many passengers?
Luckman said, deadpan.
12. Oh, is that 6 in the back, Luckman said, and 6 in the...
No, Arctor said. That's 11 in the back and the driver sitting alone in front.
So, you see, so there will be more weight on the rear wheels, more traction. So it won't fishtail.
Paris glanced alertly up.
This car fishtails?
Well, unless you got 11 people riding in the back, Arctor said.
It'd be better than to lead the trunk with sacks of sand, Paris said. 3 200-pound sacks of sand.
Then the passengers could be distributed more evenly, and they would be more comfortable.
And what about 1 600-pound box of gold in the trunk?
Luckman asked him.
Instead of 3 200... Will you lay off?
Paris said.
I'm trying to calculate the inertial force of this car traveling at 80 miles an hour.
It won't go 80, Arctor said. It's got a dead cylinder.
I meant to tell you. It threw a rod last night on my way home from the 7-Eleven.
Then why are we pulling the carb? Paris demanded.
We have to pull the whole head for that. In fact, much more. In fact, you may have a cracked block. Well, that's why it won't start.
Won't your car start?
Freck asked Bob Arctor.
It won't start, Luckman said, because we pulled the carb off.
Puzzled, Barris said,
Why'd we pull the carb? I forget.
To get all the springs and little dinky parts replaced, Arctor said,
so it won't fuck up again and nearly kill us. The Union Station mechanic advised us to. If you bastards wouldn't rappity-rap on, Barris said, like a lot of speed freaks, I could complete my computations and tell you how this particular car with its weight would handle with a 4-barrel Rochester carb modified naturally with smaller idling jets.
He was genuinely sore now.
So shut up!
Luckman opened the book he was carrying. He puffed up then to much larger than usual. His great chest swelled, and so did his biceps.
Paris, I'm going to read to you.
He began to read from the book in a particularly fluent way.
He to whom it is given to see Christ more real than any other reality.
What?
Barris said. Luckman continued reading.
Than any other reality in the world. Christ everywhere present and everywhere growing more great. Christ the final determination and plasmatic principle of the universe.
What is that? Arctor said.
Chardin. Teilhard de Chardin.
Gee, Luckman, Arctor said.
That man, indeed, lives in a zone where no multiplicity can distress him, and which is nevertheless the most active workshop of universal fulfillment.
Luckman shut the book. With a high degree of apprehension, Charles Freck moved in between Barris and Luckman.
Cool it, you guys. Get out the way, Freck, Luckman said, bringing back his right arm low for a vast, sweeping haymaker at Barris. Come on, Barris. I'm going to cold cock you into tomorrow for talking to you betters like that.
With a bleat of wild, appealing terror, Barris dropped his felt pen and pad of paper and scuttled off erratically toward the open front door of the house, yelling back as he ran.
I hear the phone about the rebuilt carb.
They watched him go.
Well, I was just kidding him,
Luckman said, rubbing his lower lip.
What if he gets the gun and silencer?
Freck said, his nervousness off the scale entirely. He moved by degrees in the direction of his own parked car, to drop swiftly behind it if Barris reappeared firing. Come on, Arctor said to Luckman. They fell back together into their car work, while Freck loitered apprehensively by his own vehicle, wondering why he had decided to bop over here today. It had no mellow quality today, here, none at all, as it usually did.
He had sensed the bad vibes under the kidding right from the start.
What's the motherfuck wrong?
He wondered, and got back somberly into his own car to start it up.
Are things gonna get heavy and bad here, too? He wondered. Just like they did at Jerry Fabin's house during the last few weeks with him? It used to be mellow here, he thought. Everybody kicking back and turning on, grooving to acid rock, especially the Stones. Donna, sitting here in her leather jacket and boots, filling caps, Luckman rolling joints, and telling about the seminar he planned to give at UCLA in dope smoking and joint rolling, and how someday he'd suddenly roll the perfect joint, and it would be placed under glass and helium back at Constitution Hall, as part of American history with those other items of similar importance. When I look back, he thought, even when Jim Barris and I were sitting at the Fiddler's the other day, it was better even then. Jerry began it, he thought. That's what's coming down here. That there which carried off Jerry. How can days and happenings and moments so good become so quickly ugly and for no reason, for no real reason? Just change, with nothing causing it. I'm splitting, he said to Luckman and Orchter, who were watching him rev up.
No, stay, hey, man, Luckman said with a warm smile. Oh, we need you. You're a brother.
No, I'm cutting out.
From the house, Barris appeared cautiously. He carried a hammer. It was a wrong number, he shouted, advancing with great caution, halting and peering like a crab thing in a drive-in movie.
What's a hammer for? Luckman said.
Arctor said, to fix the engine. Thought I would bring it with me, Barris explained as he returned gingerly to the Olds, since I was indoors and noticed it. The most dangerous kind of person, Arctor said, is one who is afraid of his own shadow. That was the last Freck heard as he drove away. He pondered over what Arctor meant, if he meant him, Charles Freck. He felt shame.
But shit, he thought, why stick around when it's such a super bummer? Where's the chicken in that?
Don't never participate in no bad scenes, he reminded himself. That was his motto in life. So he drove away now, without looking back.
Let them snuff each other, he thought. Who needs them?
But he felt bad, really bad, to leave them, and to have witnessed the darkening change. And he wondered again why, and what it signified. But then it occurred to him that maybe things would go the other way again, and get better, and that cheered him. In fact, it caused him to roll a short fantasy number in his head as he drove along avoiding invisible police cars.
There they all sat, as before.
Even people who were either dead or burned out, like Jerry Fabin, they all sat here and there in a sort of clear white light, which wasn't daylight, but better light than that, a kind of sea which lay beneath them, and above them as well. Donna and a couple other chicks looked so foxy. They had on halters and hot pants, or tank tops with no bras. He could hear music, although he could not quite distinguish what track it was from, what LP.
Maybe Hendrix, he thought. Yeah, an old Hendrix track.
Or now, all at once, it was J.J.
All of them. Jim Croce and J.J., but especially Hendrix.
Before I die,
Hendrix was murmuring.
Let me live my life as I want to.
And then immediately the fantasy number blew up, because he had forgotten both that Hendrix was dead, and how Hendrix and also Joplin had died, not to mention Croce. Hendrix and J.J. ODing on smack. Both of them. Two neat, cool, fine people like that, two outrageous humans. And he remembered how he'd heard that Janice's manager had only allowed her a couple $100 now and then. She couldn't have the rest, all that she earned, because of her junk habit. And then he heard in his head her song, All His Loneliness, and he began to cry. And in that condition, drove on toward home. In his living room, sitting with his friends and attempting to determine whether he needed a new carb, a rebuilt carb, or a modification carb and manifold, Robert Arctor sensed the silent, constant scrutiny, the electronic presence of the hollow scanners, and felt good about it.
You look mellow, Luckman said. Putting out $100 wouldn't make me mellow.
I decide to cruise along the street until I come across an olive like mine, Arctur explained, and then unbolt their carb and pay nothing, like everyone else we know.
Especially Donna, Barris said in agreement. I wish she hadn't been in here the other day while we were gone. Donna steals everything she can carry, and if she can't carry it, she phones up her rip-off gang buddies and they show up and carry it off for her.
I'll tell you a story I heard about Donna, Luckman said. One time, see, Donna put a quarter into one of those automatic stamp machines that operate off a coil of stamps, and the machine was dingy and just kept cranking out stamps. Finally, she had a market basket full. It still kept cranking them out. Ultimately, she had, like, she and her rip-off friends counted them, over 18,000 U.S. 15-cent stamps. Well, that was cool, except what was Donna Hawthorne going to do with them? She never wrote a letter in her life, except to her lawyer to sue some guy who burned her in a dope deal.
Donna did that? Arctur said. She has an attorney to use in a default on an illegal transaction? How can she do that?
Well, she probably just says the dude owes her bread.
I imagine getting an angry pay-up or go-to-court letter from an attorney about a dope deal, Arctur said, marveling at Donna, as he frequently did.
Well, anyhow, Luckman continued, there she was with this market basket full of at least 18,000 U.S. 15-cent stamps. And what the hell to do with them? Well, you can't sell them back to the post office. Anyhow, when the P.O. came to service the machine, they'd know it went dingy. And anyone who showed up at a window with all those 15-cent stamps, especially a coil of them, well, shit, they'd flash on it. In fact, they'd be waiting for Donna, right? So, she thought about it. After, of course, she'd loaded the coil of stamps into her MG and drove off. And then she phoned up more of those rip-off freaks she works with and had them drive over with a jackhammer of some kind. It water-cooled and water-silenced. A real kinky special one, which, Christ, they ripped off, too. And they dug the stamp machine loose from the concrete in the middle of the night and carried it to her place in the back of a Ford Ranchero, which they also probably ripped off for the stamps.
You mean she sold the stamps, Arctur said, marveling, from a vending machine, one by one?
They remounted, this is what I heard anyhow, they relocated the U.S. stamp machine at a busy intersection where a lot of people passed by, but back out of sight, where no mail truck could spot it, and they put it back in operation.
They would have been wiser just to knock over the coin box, Barris said.
So they were selling stamps then, Luckman said, for like a few weeks until the machine ran out, like it naturally had to eventually. And what the fuck next? I can imagine Donna's brain working on that during those weeks, that peasant thrift brain. Her family's peasant stock from some European country. Anyhow, by the time it ran out of its coil, Donna had decided to convert it over to soft drinks, which are from the P.O. They're really guarded, and you go into the bucket forever for that.
Is this true? Barris said.
Is what true? Luckman said.
Barris said, that girl is disturbed. She should be forcibly committed. Do you realize that all our taxes were raised by her stealing those stamps?
He sounded angry again.
Write the government and tell them, Luckman said, his face cold with distaste for Barris. Ask Donna for a stamp to mail it. She'll sell you one.
At full price, Barris said, equally mad.
The Hollows, Arctur thought, will have miles and miles of this on their expensive tapes. Not miles and miles of dead tape, but miles and miles of tripped-out tape.
It was not what went on while Robert Arctur sat before a Hollow scanner that mattered so much, he considered. It was what took place, at least for him. For whom? For Fred. While Bob Arctur was elsewhere or asleep, and others were within scanning range. So I should split, he thought, as I planned it out, leaving these guys and sending other people I know over here. I should make my house super accessible from now on.
And then a dreadful, ugly thought rose inside him. Suppose when I play the tapes back, I see Donna when she's in here, opening a window with a spoon or a knife blade, and slipping in and destroying my possessions and stealing. Another Donna, the chick as she really is,
or anyhow, as she is when I can't see her. The philosophical when a tree falls in the forest number. What is Donna like when no one is around to watch her? Does, he wondered, the gentle, lovely, shrewd, and very kind, super kind girl transform herself instantly into something sly? Will I see a change which will blow my mind? Donna, or Luckman, anyone I care about. Like your pet cat or dog when you're out of the house. The cat empties a pillowcase and starts stuffing your valuables in it. Electric clock and bedside radio, shaver, all it can stuff in before you get back. Another cat entirely while you're gone, ripping you off and pawning it all, or lighting up your joints, or walking on the ceiling, or phoning people long distance. God knows. A nightmare. A weird other world beyond the mirror. A terror city reverse thing, with unrecognizable entities creeping about. Donna crawling on all fours, eating from the animal's dishes. Any kind of psychedelic wild trip unfathomable and horrid. Hell, he thought. For that matter, maybe Bob Arctor rises up in the night from deep sleep and does trips like that. Has sexual relations with the wall. Or mysterious freaks show up, who he's never seen before. A whole bunch of them with special heads that swivel all the way around, like owls. And the audio scanners will pick up the far-out demented conspiracies hatched out by him and them to blow up the men's room at the Standard Station by filling the toilet with plastic explosives for God knows what brain-charred purpose. Maybe this sort of stuff goes on every night while he just imagines he's asleep and is gone by day. Bob Arctor, he speculated, may learn more new information about himself than he is ready for. More than he will about Donna and her little leather jacket and Luckman and his fancy duds and even Barris. Maybe when nobody's around, Jim Barris merely goes to sleep and sleeps until they reappear. But he doubted it. More likely, Barris whipped out a hidden transmitter from the mess and chaos of his room, which, like all the other rooms in the house, had now for the first time come under 24-hour scanning and sent a cryptic signal to the other bunch of cryptic motherfuckers with whom he currently conspired for whatever people like him or them conspired for. Another branch, Bob Arctor reflected, of the authorities. On the other hand, Hank and those guys downtown would not be too happy if Bob Arctor left his house, now that the monitors had been expensively and elaborately installed and was never seen again, never showed up on any of the tape. He could not, therefore, take off in order to fulfill his personal surveillance plans at the expense of theirs. After all, it was their money. In the script being filmed, he would at all times have to be the star actor. Actor. Arctor, he thought. Bob the actor who is being hunted. He who is the El Primo huntee. They say you never recognize your own voice when you first hear it played back on tape. And when you see yourself on videotape or like this, in a 3D hologram, you don't recognize yourself visually either. You imagined you were a tall, fat man with black hair, and instead you're a tiny, thin woman with no hair at all. Is that it? I'm sure I'll recognize Bob Arctor, he thought, if by nothing else than by the clothes he wears or by a process of elimination. What isn't Barris or Luckman and lives here must be Bob Arctor. Unless it's one of the dogs or cats. Well, I'll try to keep my professional eye trained on something which walks upright. Barris, he said, I'm going to go out and see if I can score some beans. Then he pretended to remember he had no car. He got that sort of expression. Luckman, he said, is your Falcon running? No, Luckman said thoughtfully after consideration. I don't think so. Can I borrow your car, Jim? Arctor asked Barris.
I wonder if you can handle my car, Barris said.
This always arose as a defense when anyone tried to borrow Barris's car, because Barris has had secret, unspecified modifications done on it, in its A, suspension, B, engine, C, transmission, D, rear end, E, drivetrain, F, electrical system, G, front end and steering, H, as well as clock, cigar lighter, ashtray, glove compartment. In particular, the glove compartment. Barris kept it locked always. The radio, too, had been cunningly changed, never explained how or why.
If you tuned one station, you got only 1 minute apart blips. All the push buttons brought in a single transmission that made no sense, and oddly, there was never any rock played over it. Sometimes when they were accompanying Barris on a bye, and Barris parked and got out of the car, leaving them, he turned the particular station on in a special fashion, very loud. If they changed it while he was gone, he became incoherent and refused to speak on the trip back, or ever to explain. He had not explained yet. Probably when set to that frequency, his radio transmitted A, to the authorities, B, to a private paramilitary political organization, C, to the syndicate, D, to extraterrestrials of higher intelligence.
By that, I mean, Barris said, it will cruise at...
Ah, fuck, Luckman broke in harshly. It's an ordinary six-cylinder motor, you humper. When we park in it, downtown L.A., the parking lot jockey drives it. So why can't Bob? Ah, you asshole. Now, Bob Arctor had a few devices, too. A few covert modifications built into his own car radio. But he didn't talk about them. Well, actually, it was Fred who had. Or anyhow, somebody had. And they did a few things a little like what Barris claimed his several electronic assists did. And then... On the other hand, they did not. For example, every law enforcement vehicle emits a particular full-spectrum interference, which sounds on ordinary car radios like a failure in the spark suppressors of that vehicle, as if the police car's ignition is faulty. However, Bob Arctor, as a peace officer, had been allocated a gadget which, when he mounted it within his car radio, told him a great deal, whereas the noises told other people... And most other people, no information at all. These other people did not even recognize the static as information-bearing. First of all, the different subsounds told Bob Arctor how close the law enforcement vehicle was to his own, and next, what variety of department it represented, city or county, highway patrol or federal, whatever. He, too, picked up the one-minute-apart blips, which acted as a time check for a parked vehicle. Those in the parked vehicle could determine how many minutes they had waited, without any obvious arm gestures. This was useful, for instance, when they had agreed to hit a house in exactly 3 minutes. The zzz, zzz, zzz on their car radio told them precisely when 3 minutes had passed. He knew, too, about the AM station that played the top 10 type tunes on, plus an enormous amount of DJ chatter in between, which sometimes was not chatter, in a sense. If that station had been tuned to, and the racket of it filled your car, anyone casually overhearing it would hear a conventional pop music station and typical boring DJ talk, and either not hang around at all, or flash on in any way to the fact that the so-called DJ suddenly, in exactly the same muted, chatty style of voice in which he said, "Now, here's a number for Phil and Jane, a new Cat Stevens tune called," occasionally said something more like, "Vehicle Blue will proceed a mile north to Bastoncherry. And the other units will," and so on. He had never, with all the many dudes and chicks who rode with him, even when he had been obliged to keep tuned to police info instructs such as when a major bust was going down or any big action was in progress which might involve him, had anyone notice. Or if they noticed, they probably thought they were personally spaced and paranoid and forgot it. And also he knew about the many unmarked police vehicles, like old Chevys jacked up in the back with loud, illegal pipes and racing stripes, with wild-looking hip types driving them erratically at high speed. He knew, from what his radio emitted in the way of the special information-carrying station at all frequencies when one buzzed him or shot past, he knew to ignore. Also, when he pushed the bar that supposedly switched from AM to FM on his car radio, a station on a particular frequency groaned out indefinite Muzak-type music. But this noise being transmitted to his car was filtered out, unscrambled by the microphone transmitter within his radio. So that whatever was said by those in his car at the time was picked up by his equipment and broadcast to the authorities. But this one funky station playing away, no matter how loud, was not received by them and did not interfere at all. The grid eliminated it. What Barris claimed to have did bear a certain resemblance to what he, Bob Arctor, as an undercover law enforcement officer, did have in his own car radio.
But beyond that, in regard to other modifications such as suspension, engine, transmission, etc., there had been no alterations whatsoever. Well, that would be uncool and obvious. And secondly, millions of car freaks could make equally hairy modifications in their cars, so he simply had gotten allocation for a fairly potent mill for his wheels, and let it go at that. Any high-powered vehicle can overtake and leave behind any other. Barris was full of shit about that. A Ferrari has suspension and handling and steering that no special secret modifications can match, so the hell with it. And cops can't drive sports cars, even cheap ones, let alone Ferraris. Ultimately, it is the driver's skill that decides it all. He did have one other law enforcement allocation, though. Very unusual tires. They had more than steel bands inside, like Michelin had introduced years ago in their X-Types. These were all metal and wore out fast, but they had advantages in speed and acceleration. Their disadvantage was their cost, but he got them free from his allocation service, which was not a Dr. Pepper machine like the money one. But this worked fine, but he could get allocations only when absolutely necessary. The tires he put on himself when no one was watching, as he had put in the radio alterations. The only fear about the radio was not detection by someone snooping such as Barris, but simple theft. Its added devices made it expensive to replace if it got ripped off. He would have to talk fast. Naturally, too, he carried a gun hidden in his car. Barris, in all his lurid, acid-trip, spaced-out fantasies, would never have designed its hiding place where it actually was. Barris would have directed there to be an exotic spot of concealment for it, like in the steering column in a hollow chamber. Or inside the gas tank, hanging down on a wire like the shipment of coke in the classic flick Easy Rider. That place as a stash place, incidentally, being about the worst spot on a hog. Every law enforcement officer who had caught the film had flashed right away on what clever psychiatrist types had elaborately figured out, that the two bikers wanted to get caught, and if possible, killed. His gun in his car was in the glove compartment. The pseudo-clever stuff that Barris continually alluded to about his own vehicle probably bore some resemblance to reality, the reality of Arctor's own modified car, because many of the radio gimmicks which Arctor carried were SOP, and had been demonstrated on late-night TV, on network talk shows, by electronic experts who had helped design them, or read about them in trade journals or seen them, or gotten fired from police labs and harbored a grudge. So the average citizen, or as Barris always said in his quasi-educated lofty way, the typical average citizen, knew by now that no black and white ran the risk of pulling over a fast-moving, souped-up, racing-striped 57 Chevy with what appeared to be a wild teenager spaced out behind the wheel on Coors beer, and then finding he'd halted an undercover narc vehicle in hot pursuit of its quarry. So the typical average citizen these days knew how and why all those narc vehicles as they roared along, scaring old ladies and straights into indignation and letter-writing, continually signaled their identity back and forth to one another and their peers. What difference did it make? But what would make a difference, a dreadful one, would be if the punks, the hot rodders, the bikers, and especially the dealers and runners and pushers, managed to build and incorporate into their own similar cars such sophisticated devices. They could then whiz right on by, with impunity.
"Yeah, I'll walk then," Arctor said. Which was what he had wanted to do anyhow. He had set up both Barris and Luckman. He had to walk.
"Where you going?" Luckman said.
"Donna's." Getting to her place on foot was almost impossible. Saying this ensured neither man accompanying him. He put on his coat and set off toward the front door.
See you guys later.
"My car," Barris continued by way of more cop-out.
"If I tried to drive your car," Arctor said, "I'd press the wrong button, and it'd flood up over the greater L.A. downtown area like the Goodyear blimp, and they'd have me dumping borate on oil well fires."
"I'm glad you can appreciate my position," Barris was muttering as Arctor shut the door. Seated before the hologram cube of Monitor 2, Fred in his scramble suit watched impassively as the hologram changed continually before his eyes. In the safe apartment, other watchers watched other holograms from other source points, mostly playbacks. Fred, however, watched a live hologram unfolding.
It recorded, but he had bypassed the stored tape to pick up the transmission at the instant it emanated from Bob Arctor's allegedly run-down house. Within the hologram, in broadband color, with high resolution, sat Barris and Luckman. In the best chair in the living room, Barris sat bent over a hash pipe which he had been putting together for days. His face had become a mask of concentration as he wound white string around and around the bowl of the pipe. At the coffee table, Luckman hunched over a Swanson's Chicken TV dinner, eating in big, clumsy mouthfuls while he watched a Western on TV. Four beer cans, empties, lay squashed by his mighty fist on the table. Now he reached for a fifth half-full can, knocked it over, spilled it, grabbed it, and cursed. At the curse, Barris peered up, regarding him like Mime and Siegfried, then resumed work. Fred continued to watch.
"You fucking late-night TV," Luckman gargled, his mouth full of food.
And then suddenly he dropped his spoon and leaped staggering to his feet, tottered, spun toward Barris, both hands raised, gesturing, saying nothing, his mouth open and half-chewed food spilling from it onto his clothes, onto the floor. The cats ran forward eagerly. Barris halted in his hash-pipe making, gazed up at hapless Luckman. In a frenzy, now gargling horrid noises, Luckman with one hand swept the coffee table bare of beer cans and food. Everything clattered down. The cats sped off, terrified. Still, Barris sat gazing fixedly at him. Luckman lurched a few steps toward the kitchen. The scanner there, on its cue before Fred's horrified eyes, picked up Luckman as he groped blindly in the kitchen's semi-darkness for a glass, tried to turn on the faucet and fill it with water. At the monitor, Fred jumped up. Transfixed, on monitor two he saw Barris, still seated, return to painstakingly winding string around and around the bowl of his hash pipe. Barris did not look up again. Monitor two showed him again intently at work. The odd tapes clashed out great, breaking, tearing sounds of agony. Human strangling, and the furious din of objects hitting the floor as Luckman hurled pots and pans and dishes and flatware about in an attempt to attract Barris's attention. Barris, amid the noise, continued methodically at his hashpipe and did not look up again. In the kitchen, on monitor one, Luckman fell to the floor all at once, not slowly, onto his knees, but completely with a sodden thump and lay spread-eagled. Barris continued winding the string of his hashpipe, and now a small, snide smile appeared on his face, at the corners of his mouth. On his feet, Fred stared in shock, galvanized and paralyzed simultaneously. He reached for the police phone beside the monitor, halted, still watched. For several minutes, Luckman lay on the kitchen floor without moving as Barris wound and wound the string. Barris bent over like an intent old lady knitting, smiling to himself, smiling on and rocking a trifle. Then abruptly, Barris tossed the hashpipe away, stood up, gazed acutely at Luckman's form on the kitchen floor, the broken water glass beside him, all the debris and pans and broken plates. And then Barris's face suddenly reacted with mock dismay. Barris tore off his shades. His eyes widened grotesquely. He flapped his arms in helpless fright. He ran about a little here and there, then scuttled toward Luckman, paused a few feet from him, ran back, panting now.
"He's building up his act," Fred realized.
"He's getting his panic and discovery act together, like he just came onto the scene." Barris, on the cube of monitor two, twisted about, gasped in grief, his face dark red, and then he hobbled to the phone, yanked it up, dropped it, picked it up with trembling fingers.
"He has just discovered that Luckman, alone in the kitchen, has choked to death on a piece of food," Fred realized, "with no one there to hear him or help him. And now Barris is frantically trying to summon help. Too late."
Into the phone, Barris was saying in a weird, high-pitched, slow voice, "Operator, is it called the Inhalator Squad or the Resuscitation Squad?"
"Sir," the phone tab squawked from its speaker by Fred, "is there someone unable to breathe? Do you wish—"
"It, I believe, is a cardiac arrest," Barris was saying now in his low, urgent, professional-type, calm voice into the phone, a voice deadly with awareness of peril and gravity and the running out of time.
"Either that, or involuntary aspiration of a bolus within the—" "What is the address, sir?"
the operator broke in.
The address, Barris said. Oh, let's see, the address is...
Fred, aloud standing, said, Christ. Suddenly, Luckman, lying stretched out on the floor, heaved convulsively. He shuddered and then barfed up the material obstructing his throat, thrashed about, and opened his eyes, which stared in swollen confusion.
He appears to be all right now,
Barris said smoothly into the phone.
Thank you. No assistance is needed after all.
He rapidly hung the phone up.
Jeez, Luckman muttered thickly as he sat up.
Fuck.
He wheezed noisily, coughing and struggling for air.
You okay?
Barris asked, in tones of concern.
Well, I must have gagged. Did I pass out?
Not exactly. You did go into an altered state of consciousness, though, for a few seconds. Probably an alpha state.
Oh, God! I soiled myself!
Unsteadily, swaying with weakness, Luckman managed to get himself to his feet and stood rocking back and forth dizzily, holding onto the wall for support.
Oh, I'm really getting degenerate, he muttered in disgust. Like an old wino.
He headed toward the sink to wash himself, his steps uncertain. Watching all this, Fred felt the fear drain from him. The man would be okay. But Barris, what sort of person was he? Luckman had recovered despite him. What a freak, he thought. What a kinky freak. Where's his head at, just to stand idle like that?
Okay, I could cash in that way,
Luckman said as he splashed water on himself at the sink. Barris smiled.
I got a really strong physical constitution, Luckman said, gulping water from a cup. What were you doing while I was lying there? Jacking off?
You saw me on the phone,
Barris said, summoning the paramedics.
I moved into action at...
Balls,
Luckman said sourly, and went on gulping down fresh, clean water.
I know what you'd do if I dropped dead. You'd rip off my stash. You'd even go through my pockets.
It's amazing, Barris said. The limitation of the human anatomy. The fact that food and air must share a common passage, so that the risk of... Silently, Luckman gave him the finger.